Okay, ready? Everybody settle and action.
Warning, Critique Revolve contains adult language and discussions. If you're easily offended,
you're one ugly motherfucker. Go ahead. Make my day.
Well, that's great. That's just fucking great, man.
It rubs the lotion on its skin. It doesn't even have any
control. I'm mostly coming out. Most of all.
There are
certain
rules.
Short round.
There is a planet ruled by a being of utter evil. And there is only one man who dares challenge him. They are locked in a battle to the death. A battle that will take them across the heavens.
Stop him!
A battle that will finally be fought.
I want the Hagadana brought to me.
Across the face.
Hello and welcome to Rayman Digital. And here at Rayman Digital, we're starting our own spinoff. I know you guys have heard of Critique Revolve. Well, our spinoff is Critique Revolve presents Bullet Time 80s Action Rewind. Today, we are going to start with one of my favorite cult action adventure movies ever. I am your lead host, Ryan Denton, and in the studio with me today is David Sabal.
Hello, everybody.
And Michael Flores.
Hello.
We are three of the biggest 80s nerd action fans you will ever meet. And one of the things, if you have listened to Rayman Digital before, one of the things that we like to do is cover movies that we love. So on Bullet Time 80s Action Rewind, what we're going to do is we're going to go through movies or 80s action movies and basically nerd out on them. So the first movie that we are doing is a movie that I love, and I think everyone in this room loves.
Yeah.
We are doing Masters of the Universe 1987. Now, this movie is a wonderful, great mix of nostalgia, campy fun, and action. Now, if you guys are familiar with Masters of the Universe, that is He-Man. And if you're really, really young, then you have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well, they might have watched the Netflix, right?
That's true. That's true. I keep forgetting that it was on Netflix. But Masters of the Universe was a Canon Films attempt to create a blockbuster franchise similar to Star Wars. Instead, this became a cult oddity, a cult fun fan movie, and kind of, I think, hit harder after it came out on VHS, to be completely honest with you guys.
Yeah, I think it's one of those movies that it has to marinate.
Marinate's a good word.
What's that thing that Marty McFly says after
Heavy?
He plays the song that no one liked?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you're not ready for this yet, but your kids are going to love it.
Yeah. I think that fits for Master of the Universe.
Oh, no, absolutely.
So to kind of rewind here, like the show's name, I'm going to kind of explain to you guys what we're going to do. So instead of a in-depth review of the movie, that is not what we're going to do. This is going to be more of a fan podcast show. 80s Action Rewind is going to be more us just having fun. I think one of the things that action movies and action adventure movies had in the 80s was more fun. I think there was a lot more of this disbelief and you just went in and had a good time. And I think that's what this podcast is going to be. So if you like 80s action films or action adventure films, this is going to be the show for you. So let's kind of jump right into some fun facts about the 1987 Masters of the Universe. So this movie was directed by Gary Goddard. Funny thing about Gary Goddard, this was his only feature film.
It's still a magnificent thing to have on your resume.
So what's funny is a lot of some of the things that he did was focused on theme park rides. So I think he did Captain EO and T2 3D, which T2 3D was, if you ever did that ride at Universal, that ride was the shit. So
he's like the master of escapism.
Yeah, pretty much. So this movie obviously starred Dolph Lundgren, Frank Langella, Meg Foster, and one that Mike and I forgot was Courtney Cox.
Yeah.
Yep.
And also for Star Trek fans, Robert Duncan McNeil. I had no idea he started that early.
I know.
In his career.
Oh, yeah.
Is the dude from Star Trek.
Yeah. Voyager. Oh, yeah.
Totally forgot he was in this.
Yeah. And dude.
And he's probably the one of the characters that you can kind of do without.
He doesn't need to be in the movie. Much. But he's
the
all right.
Only character I really was like, eh.
The whole human story centers around Courtney Cox's character.
Yeah.
That's it.
Dude, I'm not going to lie, man. This is 87, so I was 2 when this movie came out. But Courtney Cox is banging in this movie. She's hot.
Yeah.
She's hot, right?
She's always been attractive.
Yes.
She's always been my favorite friends, right?
Oh, yeah.
So this movie was produced by Canon Films. So they basically,
God bless Canon.
They did Delta Force and a couple other movies.
Did they really?
Yeah. Some other fun facts. This was Frank Langella's favorite role, which is, he is like a Juilliard actor. Like this guy is like a big deal.
He's really good.
And he said playing Skeletor was like his favorite role ever. Which is funny, man.
You hear that a lot from actors.
But it makes sense, though, when you actually watch Langella's portrayal of Skeletor, because he hams it up.
He does
into it.
He does. Yes, I would definitely define it as hamming it up, but also he takes it serious.
Yes. Yeah. So what's weird about his portrayal of Skeletor, and weird in a good way, right, is one, you have a Juilliard-level actor playing a character who yells, "Hey, man," in like a cartoon, but the way he played the character made me fucking scared of Skeletor. Like, think about Skeletor in the terms of Master of the Universe, the He-Man show.
He was creepy. When you were a kid, he was creepy.
So he played him how I would envision real life Skeletor would look.
Yeah.
So some of the other fun starting facts. One, Dolph Lundgren barely knew English when this movie came out. He was still learning English, basically.
You could tell.
They initially wanted to dub over his voice altogether, which I'm glad they didn't. Because I honestly didn't think he was that bad.
No, I thought he did really well, actually.
They kept his lines really simple.
Which is perfect. He's He-Man. What does he need to say?
He's like the perfect casting for He-Man.
Dude, he looked perfect.
The part.
He looked good, dude. Some of the other things, this is technically a failed franchise. This movie was meant to start a whole new series.
Oh, yeah. If you stayed to the very end.
Oh, yeah.
You stayed to the very end. So, you got that secret scene.
Basically, it grossed $17 million. The budget was $22 million. Basically killed the franchise. And yeah, it basically died. But
killed
then
it in the cradle.
Killed it before it was ever even born. Yeah.
But I don't know, man. I feel like I don't know what people expected.
Yeah.
Because when I was watching this movie, yes, it's B. Yes, it's pulpy. Yes, it's campy. But there's also some greatness to it.
Oh, yeah.
And the fact that a lot of people just didn't appreciate some of the stellar like craftsmanship that was put into the movie just blows my mind.
So one of the things that always, I think with the list of movies that we're going to do here on Bullet Time 80s Action Rewind, I feel like a lot of them, now obviously there are some staples on this list, right? But I think that is one thing that comes with 80s action movies is that I feel like sometimes the love doesn't get portrayed until later. And when I say later, I mean much later.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you rewatch a movie and you're like, oh man, this is still really great. You know? And like, and it's not member berries.
No,
it's more like this is actually a really fun and cool movie. And I think sometimes, and Mike, you talked about this before we went on air. I feel like with movies like that, the nostalgia, not member berries, helps a little, obviously, but also too, you look at this movie through a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You look at it a way of, you know, one, your love for the movie because you were young when the movie first came out or whatever is there. But also too, you see, like you said, the heart, now that we've done movies, right? But the three of us sit in here and we've reviewed a lot of movies, right?
Oh, yeah.
You look at this and you go, man, there was a lot of hard work that went actually into this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that we're going to talk about in this show, guys, is one, my favorite thing is costumes. This movie has a plethora of amazing costumes that we would be remiss not to mention.
Yeah.
Especially costumes for like the main characters and also Skeletor's henchmen. We're going to talk about props because I feel like this movie has amazing props in it. For an 80s movie, the props in this movie are unbelievable. Set design, something that I think you two film nerds can get a little into is the set design. And then also I wanted to kind of throw in matte painting too. I know that goes with set designs, but the matte paintings in this movie are dope. And then there's just, you know, some extra fun stuff at the end that we can hit on. But I think those are the main points that I want to touch, at least on this movie. Let's jump right into the costumes. And this is something that for me, as being a, you know, I don't want to say former cosplayer because I still kind of do it, but someone who knows what the work that goes into making a costume. One of the ones that I think we'll just start off is He-Man. Now, obviously, He-Man doesn't wear much. But also, too, when you look at that, like you just said, Mike, Dolph Lundgren was perfectly cast as far as body-wise. He looks, obviously, He-Man in the show is a little more Dorito-y looking.
Yeah.
You know, more, you know,
cartoony,
right?
Yeah.
But Dolph Lundgren at this time, this is the height of Dolph Lundgren, right? Like, this is when he's in, like, great shape.
Yeah.
He looks.
This is prime Dolph.
He looks unbelievable. And obviously they shifted the tone of the original cartoon. I mean, he's not wearing, spandex and purple, you know, like obviously they shifted the tone to make it look a little bit more real worldy, I guess.
They were trying to ground it.
Sure. It was more Conan style armor. He had the cape. The cape was badass. I'm not even gonna lie to you guys. I thought the cape was cool as shit. But looking at like his pauldrons and like just everything, he looked like He-Man. He looked like how you would envision He-Man stepping off of and then like turning into a real character. He looked like it.
Well, the one thing about that costume design too, it became so iconic, especially for He-Man fans, that Mattel had to later on make toys based on that look. And it's one of the most popular, most hot selling toys is that version of He-Man from Masters of the Universe. And like, you're right. It's like they took they essentially took the campiness of the original He-Man, because let's face it.
You look at the
original He-Man.
Dude, it's goofy.
It's goofy.
It's goofy, dude.
For a movie, especially with the fact that they tried to tie it it's a different dimension and it's in a different world.
Sure.
They wanted to actually, just like what Mike said, ground it, make it look real.
Yeah.
The way that actually Dolph Lundgren looks in that armor.
He looks dope.
He looks so dope.
He's believable, right?
We are in an age currently with movies where you go see your favorite franchise.
Yep.
And you scratch your head and you're like, why did you go that route? It doesn't make sense. But then you can point to He-Man, a supposed horrible movie. And you're like, well, how come they did it just right?
It makes no sense to me. Like when you look at some of these, so like the next one I want to talk about is Skeletor. So the next two characters we're about to talk about are by far the best looking characters in all of the movie. Okay. Skeletor's makeup. To this day, this movie came out in 1987, is still some of the best prosthetics I've ever seen in my life. His face, even his, you know, the dentures that he wears, scary as shit. But he also looks, like I said, Skeletor walked right off the TV and right into a movie. Dude, he looks unbelievable.
Yeah, the prosthetics are on point, especially, again, remembering the time. And for those out there that know, you know, we talk a lot about Star Trek as well. And if you go back to the 80s and look at some of the prosthetics that they have in their shows, the biggest problems you find is where you have the connection between the prosthetic mask and the eye.
Yep.
And you always see the ring. It Not doesn't go all the way to the eye. But with Skeletor's makeup, even on my 4K television, when I was watching it this morning, it's flawless looking.
My only gripe, and this is a straight nitpick, guys. So don't get too upset with me. But the only thing that I had an issue with was He-Man looks unbelievable and yoked. If you remember in the show, the cartoon, Skeletor was pretty yoked for
the characters were yoked. Like,
dude, they were like, you know, they were on some steroids, right? Like these dudes were huge, right? So my only gripe is that Skeletor didn't look super physically imposing, but I also, he was scary looking in the face.
That was the thing though, with like a lot of his costumes for Skeletor, they're very like imposing, even though he's not ripped. Like, his normal, the black costume that he wears throughout majority of the film is just
cool.
cool. It's actually big. It's bulky, kind of hides his body a bit, but it adds that almost like that villain role to him more. Makes him look more sinister.
I think they split the difference, you know, like, hey, listen,
I think you're right.
Are we going to hire, you know, Frank, what's his last name?
Langella.
Or are we going to cast another buff meathead?
We're
going to
put Macho Man Randy Savage in it.
Yeah, let's put some. let's put a B star. Okay. But also let's put an A list.
Yeah.
You know, well-trained actor as well. And I think that's also part of the reason why the Skeletor role is, it is remembered.
It is remembered. And I mean, even like later when his costume changes, the gold armor.
Yes. That was part of like what the costumes we were going to talk about.
Yeah. It's so out there.
So I think the thing for me, David, to kind of go off that is, and kind of tie up onto what Mike was saying is you took an incredible costume and facial prosthetic, and you put Frank Langella in it. And I think it brought that character more to life. And even like when you were, like you said about the gold armor, you only see the bottom half of his face and he still
looks
unbelievable. Dude, so, so good. So the next one I want to talk about, so we're going to kind of get into Skeletor's henchmen. But the first one I want to talk about, and I still think is quite possibly some of the best costume work I've ever seen, is Evil Lyn.
Oh, absolutely.
Evil Lyn. Her whole entire costume. Now, I'm talking costume, but also Meg Foster is the actress that played Evil Lyn. Okay, so obviously she had unbelievable armor. She had that headpiece. But I don't know if you guys knew this. Her eyes in the movie, those are her eyes. She does not have contacts in. To this day, every time that I do that close-up of her face, you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. What the fuck is going on?
Even in recent times, I've met Meg Foster like twice in the convention circuit. She's really nice, but her eyes, when she looks at you, it's like daggers. Like it immediately catches your attention. And it's like, oh, she's not wearing contacts.
Yeah, that's her eyes. Dude, her costume, first of all, the armor is unbelievable. Dude, I don't know how this movie pulled off these costumes to the point where you're like, for a movie that supposedly bombed, the costumes in this movie are fucking unreal.
You can see they were obviously, I mean, if the intent was to make this the next Star Wars, I would say they did the legwork.
Yeah.
But where they messed up is the script.
Yeah.
Because the costumes, the soundtrack, which I don't want to get into yet, but the costumes and everything that you see, it, I don't want to say it's on par with Lucas's Star Wars.
It's pretty close.
But it's pretty damn, I don't even know if I could say it. Would that be blasphemous
say
it's close? Because there are moments where I'm watching this and I'm like, I could see this being on like Disney Plus next week as a new Star Wars series.
Yeah. I mean, especially when you get to for me, what encapsulates that entire feeling is the ending. Because when you hear the music, when you hear the soundtrack, the dialogue that's used in there is just perfectly done. And it's like, I remember when this first came out, I saw it as a kid just in the theaters. And I watched it like 7 times as a kid in the theater. And I was shocked that basically they didn't make a sequel. Because a lot of kids liked it.
Especially when you look at all the stuff, like specifically the costumes that are involved. It's like, why didn't we ever go back?
One of the things in the original cartoon that a lot of kids liked were the side characters. Okay. Obviously He-Man had his band of, you know, people from Grayskull. And then you had Skeletor's henchmen, right? And he had a fucking plethora of henchmen. So one of the things is his henchmen bounty hunter squad. Okay. So we're talking Beastman, Sorod, Karg, Blade, and then he had the Stormtrooper looking dude. So the first one I want to talk about,
names too.
Oh, they're great.
So good.
So Beastman, who is directly from the cartoon.
Yes.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, and again, I hate to keep harping this, but they fucking pulled Beastman straight out of the cartoon and put him in it. This one, I feel like the costume obviously limited the actor. Let's be 100%. But he looked freaking cool as shit. So, so cool. He felt true. he felt like they, like I said, they pulled him straight from the cartoon. I felt like he was kind of underutilized. Beastman was kind of a big deal in the cartoon.
Well, it's just
he was
like,
used a lot.
It's just like what you said, though, the prosthetics and the, what they had to use for Beastman limited what the actor could do because the, at best that what he was wearing with the costume and the prosthetics that were on him was more than just Skeletor. And all you can do for an actor like that is say, stand right there. Here's your mark. Stand right here.
Roar a little bit.
Roar a little bit. Do something. Wave your arms.
Yeah. Old school prosthetics like this, the more detail oriented it got,
the harder it was to move.
The more difficult it was to have, you know, to be agile.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the next three characters we're going to talk about costume wise were original characters created for the movie, which I feel like I'm okay with. I still feel like they maybe could have used like maybe some other characters
from
the source material, but that's okay. So the next one is Sorod. Now this one I particularly like, but what kills me is he gets killed off so fast. And I'm like, dude, this guy looks so cool, man. So this is a reptilian bounty hunter.
He does look dope.
He's so cool looking, right?
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, well, he's dead now. Like, dude, come on, man. Like, look at the, like,
you know what this sounds like to me? It's the same story with Star Wars.
That character is awesome. Why did he die? What?
General then, Grievous, Darth Maul,
Boba Fett.
Yep.
Exactly.
Like, what are you thinking?
When you look at like what they were working with in the film, you can see that basically they were leaving these little like crumbs to all of a sudden say, oh, we'll do more in another movie or something.
Yeah. Dude, especially, he looks so badass, man.
Especially with that character, because like anyone who knows He-Man knows about like, you know, the mythos of, you know, the He-Man universe knows that that's basically a take on the reptilian, the snake men.
Yes. Oh, is it?
Yes. Yeah.
Oh,
so in essence, yeah, he gets killed, but we all know that if you're a He-Man fan, they're going to come back. That's why it was like funny when he gets killed right away, because you can kind of get, that's why as kids, a lot of kids nowadays were like, they're going to do a sequel. They're going to do another one.
I'm just saying like this, the helmet, the reptilian prosthetics.
Yeah.
Like, dude, this guy looked unbelievable. And then they just threw him away like he was trash. Like,
and you realize nowadays, people, there's a lot of projects out there that do try to do quote unquote snake men.
That's true. I mean, you're not wrong.
And it pales in comparison to this.
Ryan, do you think the reason why they had him die off early was more of a budget thing?
Yeah.
Because you're dealing with so many characters and prosthetics and costumes. Yep.
I think one of the things with a lot of these, like the next character, Karg, who is like the weird witch, white-haired looking dude, again, looks unbelievable. Like, but again, he was created for the movie for budget reasons. So I think a lot of this stuff was budget reasons. I think also too, like, think about like Triclops or Trapjaw. Like there were characters they could have put in the movie.
Merman.
Like there are so many, again, like guys, if you're not familiar with Masters of the Universe or He-Man, there's a lot of goofy characters. Okay. It is over the top.
That's why it's awesome.
That's why it's great.
It's B film excellence.
Yes. Yeah. And I think you're right, Mike. I think a lot of these characters, cause these three characters that were created, Karg, again, I was always confused by this character. I'm like, is this a girl? Is this a guy? It talks like a dude, but also like has like a raspy, and I didn't care what it was. It was just like, I'm trying to figure out this character. Yeah. And like, you know, what was weird to me.
I always got the impression they were like a witch or
that's
something.
That's what I thought. Yeah. I thought it was a witch. And he like has like a fucking claw, like hooked arm, which I never noticed until like, you know, I've seen the movie three times. I was like, oh, there's a hook hand. Again, he's so cool looking, right?
It's all the little details.
There's so many crazy details. And then like the last character, Blade. Dude, what a fucking cool character.
Yeah.
Like just another swordsman. Again, these characters, let's lot these three characters together. Think about what we had. You had Sorod, who was a badass looking reptilian bounty hunter dude, but the prosthetics are unbelievable. You had Karg, another crazy prosthetic heavy, you know, character, that kind of like stammering, scared henchman. Yeah. You remember he's like, we were attacked by 10 people. You know, like it's just He-Man, you know, like again, typical He-Man. Oh, he attacked us and there was so many of them. And he goes back and they watch it like, dude, it's just He-Man. What are you talking about? And then you got Blade. He's like, and again, I'm not. No, it's not Wesley Snipes, guys.
Okay. Oh, what a crossover that would be.
Oh my God, be amazing. Again, just a human swordsman guy, has an eye patch, looks cool.
Very 80s looking.
Very 80s. And I don't know if you guys noticed. Okay, this was one of the things that made me laugh. I never noticed this as a kid. But when you look at him and he has his eye patch, there are little holes in the eye patch so he can see through.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys noticed that.
I didn't pick up on it.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that's funny. But I think, Mike, these three characters were created, one, for budget cuts. Mm-hmm. I think... Our budget reasoning. Obviously, I don't think they wanted to try to like do Trap Jaw or any of these like crazy characters, because I think it would have been really difficult for them, right?
Oh, absolutely.
I also feel like, you know, Blade was specifically created for He-Man so they could be equal swordsmen, so there could be a sword fight. Because like, what do you want to see He-Man do? You want to see him swing the sword around. That's mm-hmm. the whole point, right? So that's why that character was created. I think Sorod was created to die. I hate to say that. They needed to kill one henchman, right? I think Beastman was there because, you know, they needed the one character.
They needed a legacy character.
Yeah, and then Karg was just kind of that one, that stammering, goofy bad guy, you know, that could be like, oh, we were attacked by 10, and then it ends up being He-Man, and then, you know, he gets scolded. I'll give you one more chance, you know, that guy, you know? There's every movie, 80s movie has that one dude who's like, you know, oh, we, you know, it's
the coward liar.
Yes. he's that character.
And not even that, it's just, it's also kind of like those 80s cartoons always have that
one character, right?
That one character. You have Starscream.
Yep, that's Starscream. Starscream is that character.
That's who that character is.
that's a good callback.
Any 80s movie you think of, like you think of any henchman in you know, Die Hard. There's always that one, like, he got away. Well, you should have got him, you know, like, I'll give you one more chance, but I'll kill you the next time. You know, like, there's that. How many times did Megatron say that to Starscream? Like, oh, like, dude,
so many times.
So what my favorite part of this movie, though, as far as costumes go, one of my favorites is their stormtroopers that they had in the movie. So one of the things, when you guys watch this movie, and I implore you, please watch this movie because it is so good. Canon wanted to make a movie, Masters of the Universe. It was Mattel at the time, right?
Yes, Mattel.
Mattel told them, hey, He-Man can't kill anybody on screen. And they said he cannot kill anyone. So they created black armored, I'm going to use stormtrooper for the lack of a better word, troopers. So He-Man could battle someone and kill them and not kill a person.
Same thing Lucas did.
Same thing.
That's why he had stormtroopers.
Yep. So their armor, I honestly thought the armor looked cool. The helmets were cool.
Yeah.
Apparently it was made super cheap. The plastic parts broke like mid scene and they had duct tape them back together.
I thought they just broke into like Lucasfilm like warehouses and
stole
we're gonna take
shadow
these.
Troopers. But yeah, I read that basically they were included mostly to give He-Man fodder for action scenes without having to risk the main henchman actors in stunts. And then also, too, because Mattel didn't want
He-Man killing
people.
Which is, it's the same reason why the Power Rangers fight putties.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's the same reason why, you know, the Ninja Turtles, the Foot Clan are robots. It's the same thing, right? Yeah, like yes. It's that same that, you know, they don't
if
want
if you want to keep your either A, the IP that you're adapting, they don't want you to change the image of the IP, or they want a specific rating. Like with Star Wars, you know, they wanted to make sure that they can keep the movie for kids. So how can we have these characters killing people if they look like humans? Well, let's have a disconnect. They're now stormtroopers. And that's pretty much essentially what He-Man did.
Yeah. And which is fine, which is absolutely fine. I mean,
yeah,
it's a tried and true method. So I feel like this movie for its time had some of the best costumes I've ever seen in my life to this day, even rewatching it. I feel like we would have been remiss not to mention the costumes. And I'm glad we all agree that they were unbelievable for what they were.
If you would have asked me that or said that a year ago and I had not rewatched, I would probably laugh and say there's no way. But again, watching this on my 4K TV, I'm looking for all the typical imperfections you see when watching an old movie on an updated high-tech television.
Yeah.
And you didn't see the typical like mistakes in the costumes. They were very well put together, and that is impressive for a 1987 film.
Yep. I think the thing, like, for me, like, I'm going to put this is going to sound really weird, and some people might be upset with me for saying this, but I'm going to put the costumes on the same level as, like, Predator.
Okay.
Like, no, I could see that.
Like, the original Predator is still, in my opinion, one of the best-looking creature prosthetic things ever created in the history of ever.
Yeah.
I mean, and if you guys know or listen to the network, you know that that's my favorite film of all time, so.
It's hard to disagree.
But
Predator has amazing.
When you look at this movie, and if you guys go back and watch, look at the costumes. All right. So the next thing I want to talk about, and this is maybe another one for me. I feel like I'm leading the show, so I can do that.
That's the point.
One of the things about this movie that kind of goes along with costumes, and that's why I put it kind of back to back, and this one will be pretty quick. We'll swindle through this one pretty quick, is the props. And this goes kind of along with the costumes, but we're going to start right off the rip with the one that is the most impressive prop in this movie, is the cosmic key.
I was going to say, I'm not going, you better bring up
the cosmic key. The cosmic key by far is the coolest prop in this movie. I remember as a kid, and even as a 39-year-old adult, when he presses the buttons and the things come out and they start spinning, in my head, I'm like, how the fuck did they do that in 1987?
Yeah,
because that is a movement and a prop and a hero prop. So if you guys are not familiar with terms of movies, a prop or a stunt prop is a prop that you see kind of in the background. It's not directly shown in the frontal frame of a shot. And then there's a hero prop. The hero prop is the one that you see right as close as possible. It's the one that's designed for close-ups. I don't know who made these cosmic keys, but that motherfucker just said, fuck it, we're just making hero props. Because that thing, every time you see it, is unbelievable. It has lights, it moves, it opens up. That is one of the coolest things I've ever seen. And I'm telling you, when I first saw this movie until now, when I rewatch it, I cannot believe how they did it.
Oh, even when they connect, they have to jury rig it and connect it to a keyboard.
Dude,
at the very end,
it looked ridiculous,
but I was like, it looks amazing.
Like, I don't know how they put it together. I would love to see the original prop. It's got to still exist somewhere.
Oh, it does. It is actually in the one of the film museums out in California.
Oh, dude, I need to see that thing in person because it is still to this day one of my favorite things I've ever seen in a movie, like prop wise.
So my question then is, so this prop was literally designed to have those weren't optical effects. No. Those were
Those were actual practical effects.
Wow.
And like,
I thought they might have been added like either in camera.
Really?
So while they're shooting, optical.
Yeah.
Or they were added in later.
A lot of like because I got the chance to actually see the prop in the museum, because it's in a museum that also has one of the few remaining Yoda props, the actual puppet. And the cosmic key is actually in there. And when you actually look at it, you can see all the wiring and the lights that they actually put into
That's
it.
That's unbelievable.
And it's like, holy crap, this thing literally lights up.
Okay, so David. So the original static cosmic key prop was crafted using a combination of plastic, rubber, foam, and metal components. And in addition to those elements, it was wired for lighting effects.
That's fucking...
meaning the prop could light up during filming to mimic powerful activations or portal openings.
Yeah, dude, that...
And I remember reading in the museum a lot, like the breakdown of the prop maker.
Mm-hmm.
He specifically wanted to design the cosmic key to be on camera so that you don't have to use optical effects.
Dude, that thing is unbelievable, man.
That's cool. Press the button and it activates, and you can just add a little, you know, like they used little light effects in editing to kind of bring out the light more.
Of course.
And
yeah.
Stuff like that. But
certainly some of the things. Yes.
In actuality, when they're pressing the buttons, it's activating.
Yeah,
it's lighting and spinning. And
it is by far, I'm going to say this, it's the best prop in this movie. Without a doubt. It is
very stunning looking.
It's unbelievable. So
is that made up for the movie?
Yes.
Because I'm not a super He-Man nerd.
It's solely for the movie.
It's crazy, right?
Yeah, it looks great.
So moving on, talking about props, I feel like there's two props we absolutely have to mention, and I'm going to mention them both at the same time. One is obviously He-Man's sword.
The power sword.
Come on. And the other one is Skeletor's staff.
I will say Dolph is pretty not safe with that sword because he's running with it.
Yes.
And it looks like he's going to stab one of his compatriots. What's the woman's name from his world?
Tila,
yeah. He's running towards her to hug her, and he is
like running at her. Like,
dude, be careful, bro. You're about to stab her.
The sword is a very, very good reimagining of the original sword that you see in the cartoon. Obviously, if they made the original sword for the cartoon, it would have been a little bit more bulky, obviously.
Yeah, more rounded.
More rounded, more bulky. So apparently, just a fun fact, the sword, there was three versions of the sword. They made a full-blown steel version of the sword that they were going to have Dolph use for like hero shots. And they said it was so fucking heavy that he couldn't use it. So the sword that he's using,
I think they didn't have him use it.
No shit.
He would have been mowing people down by accident.
Dude, so the one he uses in the movie is aluminum. So he can swing it around. Right.
Yeah.
But yeah, so apparently they made a couple different versions of the sword. I mean, I think it looks unbelievable. Plus, too, like mixed with Dolph holding it, and even like you said, David, at the end when he's, you know, screams, "I have the power."
Oh, it
like,
works, dude,
come on!
I love it.
It's fucking great.
Yeah. Or even the action, the hero shots with that sword when you know he's when Skeletor is shooting his lightning and He-Man's trying to grab it. Those close ups of the sword, dude, is great, just dope.
The other one that we would be just absolutely dumb to not mention is Skeletor's Havoc staff.
The Havoc staff, yeah.
Dude, first of all, one of the coolest things that Skeletor ever had in the show was his staff, right? But they made this thing look unbelievable. Like, it looked, again, I keep saying this, but they did such an amazing job in this movie of pulling things directly from the cartoon and making them look realistic. And with Langella, like, holding it, apparently, I didn't notice this, he has this thing in every scene.
Yeah.
Like, he's got it. He does never not have it. And even when they make it gold, it is fucking badass looking, dude. Like, it is the perfect, straight off the cartoon fucking pages, making Skeletor staff look badass. And I don't know
if you got about Skeletor in this movie.
Was so good.
I would say perfect.
Yeah,
it is. It's perfect. It is the best word.
Take it into context, of course, the 80s.
Yes.
But I think for the 80s, I mean, dude, not even just the 80s. I mean, his prosthetics are freaking amazing, dude.
Still to this day.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. In hindsight, when you take a look at this film, it's amazing. It's one of those films that everyone kind of looks at and goes, why did this bomb?
And then, yeah, and then they watch
it. And then they watch it, and they're like going, well, it really did deserve a bomb.
No, it doesn't.
It's not a bomb.
No, it didn't, because when you look at all the other garbage that came out of the 80s.
Yeah.
Why does this movie face everyone's wrath? I mean, this movie is better than like 90% of the 80s shit.
Oh, yeah. It's true. So one of the things that we'll just kind of talk about, because I did really like this scene, is when they get into Gwildor's, his little hole, his hobbit hole, if you will. All of the cool little knickknack and mad inventor gadgets that are sitting around his, I feel like at the time and in the 80s, and you guys can chime in with this too. I feel like in the 80s, and this is going to lead us directly into the next topic we're going to talk about. They did such a great job of creating this ambiance and this believability on the set of, like, you walk into this guy's hobbit hole, for the lack of a better word, and you're like, this guy clearly invents shit. Like, you look around and then, like, you see Man at Arms and he's like touching these gizmos and you're like, okay, this guy's clearly an inventor, right? But they did such an amazing job in the 80s of making you feel,
or the art direction.
There's just like this, that scene, and I know it's such a quick throwaway scene, but
those scenes matter.
They do.
It adds legitimacy.
It's a lot of like the set design choices that they made with making sure that people feel that they are in Eternia. They're not in some like random sci-fi. Yep.
And that, David, literally from your point, leads us into our next segment, what we're going to talk about. And this is where I think the next two, where you guys can really nerd out, is the first one we're going to talk about, set design. I feel like this movie, has some of the best set design for an 80s movie as far as pulling you in and making you feel like you're part of that big action. Now, one of the things that I want to talk about, if you guys do watch this movie, budget concerns are a huge thing. I feel like, and I think Mike, we had discussed this, that this movie probably would have been even cooler if it was all set in Eternia.
Right. Cause the mistake of this movie is that they decided, because of budget reasons, to go to Earth.
Yep.
And that's where the movie kind of, I don't want to say it loses itself, but it loses quality because you have that 80s yep. funk that doesn't quite adhere to the fantasy.
Yeah.
So to piggyback off that, so the first one I want to talk about is the Earth location. And it's so most of the film takes place in a small town, California. There's a high school, a music shop, suburban homes, and it's purely a budget choice, right?
Yeah.
But the thing, it made the movie feel kind of fish out of watery. Like it felt like it was like, oh, but also.
You think it gave it its like unique vibe a bit?
But also it gave it that vibe of like, oh damn, like He-Man's in suburbia. Like, I know that sounds dumb,
but it's true.
But it kind of gave it its charm too as well. Even though I understand why they did it and it makes total sense, I think it also gives the movie charm of like, well, what if He-Man came into my town?
But that's exactly why they do it.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the strategy for that type of storytelling, is because you want to actually make your audience feel like this character can be real. And that was ultimately what, when you look at the making of Masters of the Universe, what Cannon wanted to do. They wanted to make He-Man seem real to everybody.
Yep.
To the point where, you know, like, just like what you mentioned earlier, Mike, they want the Lucas effect. They want He-Man to be just as big as Star Wars.
So like a possibility. Like with Star Wars, it's a galaxy far, far away.
This is a galaxy close.
But I get that.
By a little crystal ball.
I do get that idea that if you bring this a little closer to home, that it allows the escapism to take on a whole new meaning.
Yeah.
That these are possibilities. And I do agree with that with a lot of different IPs, that the possibilities that this could happen is usually its strength.
Yep.
But for me, I don't know if it works for He-Man, at least for me.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the weakest element. I don't want escapism on Earth. I want to leave this planet.
Well, especially
I want to go to Eternia.
To your point, Mike, also like the way that Langella and Dolph Lundgren played off of each other. The way that He-Man and Skeletor absolutely played with each other.
That's a little homoerotic. It was,
yeah, but throughout the entire film,
phrasing.
They had like a history that they honestly made the audience say, oh, okay, they've been fighting this for this long. What's been going on?
I understand Mike's gripe. I get it. I get that. I think one of the best sets in the entire movie is the Eternia throne room. It is so cool. It is the most expensive set they built. Of course, it was supposed to look vast and imposing. The way they did it, and you guys can chime in here, there was some heavy shadow to kind of hide, you know, details being missing or things
absolutely.
Which is 100% okay.
That's called filmmaking.
It's film,
yes.
Right?
Like I agree with you that this is the best scene or the best set. And if the entire movie took place in that throne room,
you'd be cool with it.
I would be fine with it because the opening 10 minutes of this movie
dope.
Is amazing. And yes. I'm saying this from a critical perspective,
yes.
Not a fan perspective. It is mind-blowing what they accomplished. The matte paintings, the way they use light to shape character. So where they might have skimped on costume for certain characters or in order to hide some of the imperfections, the need to cut on budget, they use the light the right way. Yep. They shape the light so that we pay attention to what needs to be in focus and never mind these other things here. And in fact, we're going to crush the blacks a bit, leave it in darkness. And by doing that, you just create this almost an unworldly feeling. It feels very demonic in the throne room with that pale light that they're using to create contrast.
Yep.
It's beautiful expert work.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing is about, like, there's a lot of craftsmanship when it comes to the set designs of this film. And a lot of people basically just pass it away. Just say, oh no, just, it's supposed to be campy and cheesy. Who cares about the details? But that's what makes this film so special.
I don't know if I would say this rivals Star Wars, but I will say this rivals many of the scenes from Indiana Jones.
So yeah. I'm going to tell you guys. So
you knew what I was going to say. Yeah. Dude, it rivals many of those, especially the Temple of Doom, the torture scene where you rip the heart out.
Yeah.
Like that entire scene, that sequence, that set. I mean, it rivals stuff like that.
It really does. And I think, so one of my favorite shots in this movie, and this might be blasphemous to everyone, it is one of the Earth shots. And what it is they're on the rooftop. And Skeletor's like hoverboard.
No, that's dope. Yeah.
And he, but so I
hoverboard
or hover fucking raft or whatever the fuck you want. Dude, that shot where you just see Skeletor sitting there on the fucking thing and he slowly comes up, dude, I'm like, what? Like, and I remember feeling that way as a kid.
Yeah.
Like, whoa. And then I'm a 39-year-old man and I'm rewatching this scene going, holy shit, that's so cool.
Yeah. And he's just has that staff.
Yes,
he looks just sitting on the throne.
So badass, dude. But one of the things, so I'm going to lot set design in with matte paintings. And I'm going to tell you right now, guys, this movie has some of the coolest matte paintings I've ever seen. And one I wanted to mention that goes along with set design is Castle Grayskull.
Oh yeah.
Dude, it looks dope. And it's a throwaway 10-second shot of Castle Grayskull in the background.
But you still, the fact that they established it and the way it looks.
Yes.
Well, it shouldn't surprise us because a little bit of tidbit of information that you shared with me prior to the show.
Yes.
It's the same artist that did the He-Man matte paintings also did Blade Runner. Mm-hmm. And Star Trek, the motion picture. And both those movies to this day, if you push play,
are masterpieces
when it comes to the visuals.
Yep. Yeah. Jeffrey Farr is the artist. And it also is a testament to the
amount of effort
they put into this movie.
Yeah.
And I think because it bombed, I think because it grew a cult following, people, like you said, David, kind of just shrug it off. Mm-hmm. They just kind of shrug it off and like, that was a, you know, He-Man movie that sucked.
People that like it, just like it. They don't really stop to think oftentimes that there is some serious craftsmanship involved in making this.
Like we talked about the throne room already. There was an insane amount of matte painting done inside the throne room to make it feel like big. And to me, as someone who loves sets, who loves props, costumes, things like that, this is craft. This is an insane craft of taking a small space and making it look big or epic just basically by painting.
Yeah, that's largely what Star Wars did, specifically in New Hope, to create those large scenes with stormtroopers, like in the hangar bays.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great way to get what you need without having to buy out a giant, you know,
soundstage and shit.
Yeah.
A really great example of that is, like, my favorite scene obviously is the very end, but like in the ending where Skeletor gets all the power and the way they use the lighting and the matte painting in that, basically when he transforms into the gold armor.
It's one of my favorite parts.
It is one of the most epic moments for me because I'm like going, evil wins.
David, good. That's the moment that I think. Okay, so when I work in the studio, I usually will have like Pluto TV on playing like classic films. He-Man came on and it had been years since I watched it. And it happened to be the ending that I caught. And I'm looking over there, I'm like, holy shit, that looks really good. It does. It still looks good.
I think that's what brought on
this. There's so many movies nowadays that you remember Willow being good as a kid, and then you rewatch it and you're like, oh my god, the horror. How did I think this was good? But I'm looking at the sequence at the ending and it just blew my mind. I cannot believe this looks that great. And then Ryan walks in and he just happens to bring up He-Man, and this is
how we started the show.
That was the conception of the show.
It's to piggyback off the final fight, some of the things that I learned is, one, there's almost nobody in there.
Yeah.
So apparently Canon ran out of money.
Of course, because and they do that.
They ran out of money and they sent almost all the crew home. So they filmed that on a bare soundstage and they lit it super dark.
Yes.
To hide basically the emptiness, which also though gives it gives it a feel of like, this is epic, right? These two guys are locked.
This goes back to what we talk about a lot, Ryan. And I think you and I too, David, that sometimes you need to have constraints.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Money constraints, whatever it may be, because you have to work harder. You have to think, you have to be creative. And largely, that's what this movie is a product of, is being creative. How can we do something like Star Wars, but we don't have nearly the budget or the time? And they had to be creative. Now, I wish they were creative with the script, because ultimately, that's the bane of this movie. The screenplay is awful. Everything else is great.
But like that exact scene that you guys are talking about is like hilarious to me, because I always go back to that as one of my clear examples of, how do you do a masterful scene with limited anything?
Yeah.
Because like when the fight starts, it's the funniest thing because everything gets dark. You have two lights, Mike, just two, a purple light and a white light blasting on both sides. Two actors flipping their swords back and forth between each other in pure darkness.
Yeah. It looks dope.
So
cheapest thing I've ever seen.
So some fun. I want to kind of slowly wind down here and kind of get close to wrapping up. Some fun facts that I think, one you already mentioned, David, is the post-credit stinger where Skeletor pops out, says, "I'll be back." I guess he was doing an Arnold thing.
Yes.
Was he really?
Yes.
Oh wow.
So
that's where the hackiness. His way
to the surface. That was the first movie ever, Mike, that told me you must sit through the credits from now on, kid, because you don't know what's going to happen till the very end.
Another funny coincidence. The canceled sequel. They were going to do a sequel. They canceled it. And the costumes and sets were repurposed into a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie. Guess what movie, Mike?
Yeah.
Cyborg.
Yeah. Well,
they should have just did a sequel.
So we talked earlier a little bit about Mattel kind of giving the no kill rule for He-Man. They also had some other rules. He-Man could never lose his sword.
Yes.
And Skeletor couldn't die. He can only be defeated or banished. Again,
that one I understand.
That one's the two major characters.
Is there something from the source material that would validate that rule, that would make that rule make sense?
Well, yeah, because
the sword. Like,
The sword thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, because like no matter what, he can't lose the sword.
He's not He-Man if he loses the sword. He's not
human if he doesn't.
Okay.
He loses the connection to Castle Grayskull.
The music in the movie was done by Bill Conti. So he was did Rocky. And you know, I felt like the music really matched with the movie.
The score was awesome.
Score's great, right?
Amazing.
I couldn't believe that was a score. I didn't remember it being that good. It's actually good, and it does feel very, this might be blasphemous, but you can tell they were trying to go for that Star Wars vibe it sounded very close to a John Williams score.
Oh, yeah. I'll tell you right now, Mike, that score, that is the score that basically, and I will be blasphemous, that score makes scores today
look
terrible,
without a doubt.
So obviously the legacy of this movie for today is, even though it failed technically,
we're talking about it.
It's still being talked about by millions of fans.
This film has a passionate cult following. Many fans discovered it on VHS in the late 80s and 90s, and it keeps the reputation alive for this movie. And I think this is why this was a perfect pick for the first Bullet Time 80s Action Rewind. I think this movie, that name is, I'm going to blow the name. The name's great.
I like it.
Dude, it's a great name for a show. Sorry, I hate to blow that. You can edit that out, Mike. But this movie epitomizes essentially what this show is going to be about. This show is going to be about, one, the three of us having fun in here.
No complaints.
Just enjoying Hollywood campy baloney. So the next two movies that we have coming up, and I'm not sure which order, is going to be Escape from New York, Snake Plissken. And the other one is going to be Clash of the Titans. Now it's technically the original. That's technically an adventure movie, but we're gonna cut it a little slack because Bubo's the shit.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's 80s.
And so. The Kraken. Yeah. So, you know, whatever. Yeah, that movie's flashing in my head right now. And we're gonna do something a little different because this is a Critique Revolve show. We aren't even gonna rate these. In our minds, these are all hundreds.
It would be blasphemous.
Blasphemous. These are all hundreds in our minds. So with that, guys, that's going to do it for the first ever episode of Bullet Time 80s Action Rewind. And we look forward to talking to you guys later. See ya.
Cut. No good for sound.
Well, fucking hell, Lloyd.
Man, game over, man. It's game over. What the fuck are we going to do now? What are we going to do?
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
I'll be back.